Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Fake the Nation, episode 367.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where I admit that, no, I haven't seen Barbenheimer yet. I am your host, Nagin Farsad, and I haven't even planned my Barbie experience. I haven't planned my Oppenheimer experience. I want to see it in an IMAX theater out of respect for the craft. And I haven't gotten tickets. I feel overwhelmed. I feel like I'm already too late. The world has already seen it. Everyone's trying to fucking spoil shit for me. I already know about something about a mink coat. I'm mad. Okay. Now, today, we're not going to talk about the worldwide cultural phenomenon that is Barbenheimer, but we will talk about those people with perfect vacations and how they're making everyone crazy. We'll dip into the crude political world with DeSantis missteps and with Bidenomics. And finally, we'll ask, does your first love shape your life forever? Today's panel, folks, this is an award-winning panel, and the awards have been doled out by Fake the Nation. The first award goes to just wonderful, wonderful dude is the award that he gets. He's author of the book Go Back to Where You Come From. He's co-host of the podcast Democracy-ish, which is a podcast I subscribe to that everyone should subscribe to. He's just a phenomenal writer, talker, fucking, like I said, wonderful dude awarded by Fake the Nation. He is the one and only Wajahat Ali. Hey, Waj.
Hey, hey, Nagin. I'm proud to be here, even though it's obvious you hate America because you haven't seen Barbenheimer and you're a weak woman for only having one child. But other than that, other than that, I really, really appreciate being here.
Thank you so much, Waj. And just like tread carefully because you've gotten the award. But you can lose the award throughout the course of this one episode. You know what I'm saying? We're not afraid of retracting awards here.
As an award losing author, I will do everything I can to be in your good graces.
Okay, and also joining us now, he's joining us for the first time on this show. But I have had the just distinct pleasure of seeing this man perform live. He's so fucking funny. He's so
fucking. Is that right?
He's so funny. You can actually hear his material on Spotify. You could also read his book. It's called Pardon My Spanglish if you want to read a book. But I mean, his material is great. If you could see him live, that's what you should do. It is the one and only Bill Santiago.
Yay! I'm so happy to be here.
And Bill, you won best first time guest
really?
On Fake
Already?
The Nation, and you haven't even done it yet.
Oh, that's
how amazing you are as a stand-up comedian.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wish every day were this.
You might lose it. You might lose it.
I know. Be careful.
I'm aware of that.
Be careful, both of you. Okay, but before we get into the show, I just want to remind listeners that you can catch bonus episodes of the pod by subscribing to our Patreon at patreon.com/NaginFarsad. The bonus pods are where the wild things are, if you will. They're just like fun and wacky, and everyone just has like a breeze on their shoulders, whatever that means. And so go to patreon.com/NaginFarsad, and for as little as $4 a month, you can get bonus episodes. Now, some of you have also been enjoying recap pods. We did recaps of Succession. We did recaps of The Bear. Thank you so much to all of you who listened to those. We are going to be doing more recaps in the fall. And we are taking your suggestions. So if you have recap ideas, I'm all ears. They don't have to be TV shows. They could be movies. So hit me up. But they probably can't be books because it takes me like 1 year to read a book. It takes me so long. It wasn't, you didn't used to be like this, but it's with the child, with the one child, because I only have one, which is something that parents of two and three will never let you forget. Parents of two and three children are like Harvard alums, where like when you go into a room with them, they'll be like, oh, you only have one. Well, I have three. Like they always remind you that they have three. And I'm always like, please shut the fuck up. But I love you. All right, here we go. Let's get into the show with topic number one. We read a piece in Vox called Stop Trying to Have the Perfect Vacation, You're Ruining Everyone Else's by Rebecca Jennings. And in the piece, she makes the case that entitlement and endless optimization have turned travel into an unfun blood sport. Now, just from that description, Waj, does that ring true for you?
I mean, yes, because I have three kids, as we've already mentioned. I'm one of those. And as a person who has, like, even if you have a child, if just doing anything with a young person is difficult, right? Surviving, especially in a post-pandemic America. So the fact that you're telling me that you've manicured a perfect vacation during the time of rising income inequality, rising fascism, a post-pandemic world, and then, of course, nothing really happens unless you share it, because if you don't share it, it didn't happen. Yeah. So then all I say, I literally sit there and I go, how did you have a time to go do this and not become a serial killer? You must not have children.
Yeah. I mean, Bill, where are you on levels of research?
You mean on this topic?
You're like, I didn't even read the article. No,
because I watched the TikTok. That's it.
So let's talk about that TikTok. So basically, this article featured a TikTok that was of this American complaining about the Amalfi Coast. And she was just like, yeah, the Amalfi Coast is beautiful, but what they don't tell you is like the logistics of actually getting there. And she wrote, like, you know, she talked about how she had to take a flight to wherever and then take a train from that airport to the whatever, and then she had to walk upstairs and she
166.
166 stairs. She numbered it. And then she said, this is literal manual labor, not vacation. Which is in the caption. What did you think of that video?
I thought that was, she had the fantastic, the perfect vacation.
I know.
That's what vacations are about. You got to live to tell the horror story.
Yes.
No one wants to hear about your perfect vacation. If you haven't been medevaced to an emergency room, then, you know, you haven't gotten your money's worth. This is fantastic stuff that she's putting out there.
She was so mad. It's so funny because, and here's the thing. I think, like, you have to embrace the process.
The problem of it. The horror, the torture.
And because also there's like these little interesting things. And I may have mentioned this, but I've been chasing. There was a slice that I ate at the Milan fucking train station. And I've mentioned it on this podcast before. I love this slice of pizza so much. And it was part of the irritating, let's say, if you want to call it that, travel between towns and whatever and getting to a thing because it wasn't easy to get to the blah blah blah, you know. But then I had like the best pizza of my entire life in this train station or whatever. And you just have to embrace like these little, you know. I remember like in Romania having to, there were, part of the train tracks were broken, so then they got us off a train, we had to walk through dirt and then get on to another train after the broken track. So that's how they handled the problem, was just like they didn't fix it, they just were like, forever we have two trains now, one that goes to the broken part and then one that picks you up from the broken part, you know. And it's like, that's fucking cool to me. I don't know, you know?
I just think that, you know, complaining about it is definitely an American thing. I was in Cuba once, and we were traveling to the country on some bus, and it was really dark. And on top of some mountains, the bus broke down. It just broke down.
Yeah.
And nobody asked a question for like 6 hours. No one even quit. Like, they just sat there in the dark. No one said anything. And then the bus driver left. No one asked where he went. And when he came back with like a wrench 6 hours later, And then he asked who wants to get off the bus to help us push to get it started. And nobody yelped about it. Yeah, nobody tweeted. Yeah. Everyone just totally accepted it. And
obviously,
it's just the part of getting across the island.
You know, we can talk about their internet infrastructure in Cuba at another time. Recognize that that's a problem before I start getting like hate mail about this. But I see the point you're making, which is just sort of like these are the things and they happen. It's fine.
In all seriousness, what it separates those people who truly want to understand how most people live, right? If you're a traveler, if you're lucky enough to travel, and most Americans haven't even used their passports, right? So do you want to be that obnoxious person who goes as a tourist and comes back after you're manicuring your perfect like life? Or do you want to actually like be a worldly global person who sees and understands how people live? And I think if you have that experience filled with challenges and hardships, and you're like, oh wow, I'm in Nepal as I was, and I'm in a 5-star hotel in a village where, let's just say, the 5-star hotel was a 1-star hotel. But for the people who were there, they were like, I talked to this guy one time. He says, I live in the jungle. No one's ever seen a computer before. This is amazing. And so here we are in this like 1-star hotel that is a 5-star hotel with basic amenities. But like the fact that I'm with these people who for them, this is like the greatest experience of their life. And you're like, wow, this is how a vast majority of humanity lives. And you just get stories and it builds character and it makes you like a less of a douchebag.
I mean, I think part of the problem with this episode is that the three of us appear to be of not totally American origins. And so, am I right, Bill? You
Puerto Ricans are technically Americans, but I get your point.
Okay. I mean, how American, though?
Pretty,
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
Since 1898.
but the idea being we're just a little maybe more comfortable with like these other like experiences, right? With other like living standards and whatever. But the other thing that this article brought up are now the people that are really ruining vacation are the people that make the spreadsheets and the intricate decks and they post all of their things on various apps and you can follow the pins of other people's itineraries so that you end up going to the best lobster place in Maine and then the best blah blah blah, and so then everyone finds out the same list and goes to the same thing. Now, where are you guys when it comes to list traveling?
I would never do it.
How do you find the places you're gonna go to when you go?
Random.
Okay, you just like happen into
it. I just go.
Yeah. I would say I do a hybrid because of the very reason that it's I've found it over the years annoying to just end up at the same places that everyone ends up at, you know? And then there's an annoying thing where you come back from that place and they go, did you try the blah, blah, blah? It's the best blah, blah, blah in blah, 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 right? And guys,
some
I
of my best friends are from blah, blah, blah.
Yes. And then you go, no, I didn't try that one thing that's apparently the best thing that I should have tried, right? Because I was a little bit more random with the way that I ate things or experienced things. So it kind of cuts both ways. But I also, I do find it annoying that we've listified all of our travel experiences. Have you encountered this feeling?
We also listify life, right? So it's all about like constant productivity, and you need a bucket list, and you need a list of self-improvement, and you need a list to do another list. And if you haven't fulfilled the list, like you're a failure, right? So it's one of those situations where Americans are like just obsessed about like improving yourself, being better, don't waste time, don't chill. And if you have the luxury of going to another country, sometimes going back to the first point, to really absorb the country and the people, sometimes you just take a walk. You take a walk and you talk to people and you do your research there and you say, hey, all the tourists are going to this 5-star restaurant. And then usually the locals are like, dude, that's a piece of shit restaurant. Let me tell you where you get the best kebab. Take a left by the cart, then go straight. Then there's a dirt road. Take a right. Then if you survive crossing the bridge, you'll have the best kebabs of your life. And if you're willing to go on that adventure, you're like, holy shit, this was the best kebab. Let me post it on Instagram.
Yeah. I think I've gotten to the point where I don't feel, I mean, I've posted some vacation-y things, but I don't know.
There's an awful lot of people who are just not interested in the kinds of vacations you're talking about. They don't want to explore. They don't really want to get embedded with other people's cultures. They don't want the experience of living in another country. That's why all those cruise ships are so popular.
You have thousands of people going from port to port
to specifically not find out what that country's about.
It was actually really depressing to me in this article. They interviewed Rick Steves for the article, and he's like the OG of travel fucking whatever. You know, he has that PBS show. What's it called? I think it's literally called Rick Steves Europe or Rick Steves, you know, South America or something. And he was like depressed because he was like, when I started doing this, there wasn't anyone doing this. So it's like, I would just go and say, here's like the five general things about this place. And no one knew. And now here's my question. The problem is, if we want to call it a problem, is the democratization of travel. Now it's accessible to middle class people, which is great because now people, I mean, you know, like me, whatever the middle class definition is, I don't know. But like regular people can travel, which is obviously better. It shouldn't be an elite sport. But at the same time, it then creates volume that places can't handle. And then it creates really annoying TikTok videos like the one we described. So where do you stand on the idea of the democratization of travel?
Well, first of all, Rick is complaining because he's losing market share. You know, he's no longer the list master.
He is not.
Travel is not accessible to everybody. It's accessible to more people, but there's still an awful lot of people who go nowhere anytime because it just costs too much money.
Yep.
You know, you got to not just pay for the travel. You got to pay for whoever's going to like care for the kids if you're not bringing them along.
Right. I mean, this isn't, whatever. I don't think they were making the case that it's more accessible to working class people, but it is more accessible to middle class people. In a way that it didn't used to be, I think.
Well, even like the Wright brothers could not have imagined what their industry would turn into.
No.
You know, when they were flying their little contraption over
They couldn't have pictured the Hard Rock Cafe.
They couldn't have pictured what a horrific experience it would turn into, that you're trapped in this aluminum tube at 40,000 feet. You got to take off your shoes. You can't wait to get off. It's a completely dehumanizing experience. And now that is the part of the travel that people don't want to put up with. There's no other way to get there, and they complain about it because it's so awful that just getting there safely is no longer enough.
Well, what you're saying, right, even though we have more options, it's a reflection of the increasing polarization of the country, where the rich have gotten richer, and if you can afford it, which less people can. I remember I got this free first class ticket just like because I was giving a speech last week, and I always tell people that if most Americans like experience first class, if they actually knew how first class people traveled, I think the country would burn down to the ground. I think like the next day there would be like mass riots. Like people don't know, right? Because people think they're rich in this country, but they're poor. It's like that part of the American dream. I'm doing well. Actually, you're in the bottom 25%. I am. So I feel like one of those situations where like, if all these advances in technology that we have, but there was more equitable and people were able to travel in a way where they didn't feel like they were like human cargo, it'd be one of the situations that, number one, if it was more affordable and better quality, more people travel. Because again, most Americans have never used their passport. Most Americans have never gone anywhere. They don't go to Canada. They go to Mexico. And the second thing is, I think going back to the kind of theme that we have, is they would have some extra money to then just spend time in the place that they're at, instead of just being an Instagram tourist, if you will.
I've said this before, but I'm just a fan of like, don't take photos anywhere when you go.
Don't take any photos. I couldn't do that.
Buy a point and click so that the photos, I haven't taken my own advice on this, so that the photo is like a thing you're doing on purpose. You know what I mean? It's not like a mindless, I'm always taking photos thing. I don't know. Folks,
Nagin, men need purpose. You need to let us men pretend that we're Federico Fellini.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Do you know how many photos I took just today on the way over here?
I mean, literally, why?
No one used to watch the video, by the way, guys. No one watched the video afterwards.
No, I know. No one. No, exactly. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break to learn about our sponsors. And when we come back, we will get into it with other topics. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we are back, and let's get into it. What topic number two? Let's be gross for a second and talk about Ron DeSantis. And as I do so, I even wonder if it helps anyone to mention any of this. But alas, Ron DeSantis has doubled down on a campaign stop about an assertion that is now being required in Florida middle schools to be in their instruction that, quote, slaves develop skills which in some instances could be applied for their personal benefit. So, you know, Ron DeSantis has had like the opportunity to like walk that back or whatever, but he hasn't. He's doubled down on this. This, I guess, idea that there is a silver lining to slavery, which is totally insane. What do you think of the Ron DeSantis moment?
Positive spin is the problem. I mean, technically, they're right. You get skills out of any experience. Harriet Tubman developed a lot of skills. Networking, obviously.
Right. That was a skill that she took away. Yeah.
Navigating by stars.
Yes.
Throwing dogs off the scent. You know, I don't know if this is something you want to put on your post-emancipation
I don't even
resume.
Know.
You know, I don't know what the spin is at the schools. I don't really understand.
It's a part of
right.
The Florida Department of Education's work group that they basically, the Stop Woke Act, you know, the DeSantis passed in 2022 that wanted to target lessons like white privilege and get them out, and basically wanted the idea is that not to make any of the white students feel guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress as part of their curriculum. So that was everything about all of this is so upsetting. Let's just, which I think we all agree, it's fucking horrendous. Where is Ron DeSantis as a candidate?
So I've said this for about 2 years, and I wrote an article about it where I call Ron DeSantis a wet noodle, and I said he will wilt in the spotlight. He just doesn't have it. Whatever it is, he doesn't have it. And as we have seen, especially as we're recording this, is that even these Republican donors who tried to make him into a thing, like he's like the invisible cola of GOP candidates. And after a while, you're like, bro, he just isn't it. He isn't right. It, right? He likes the charisma, the cruelty of Florida, as evidenced by what you said, the Stop Woke Act, Don't Say Gay, doubling down on slavery as having benefits. The fact that, now we're seeing finally, they're putting a microscope under DeSantis's rule in Florida, and they're looking at all the deaths that could have been avoided had these people not attacked science and vaccines, the climate change effect in Florida. It's like a disaster zone. And I believe as a candidate, he will further wilt. If Trump does die or gets goes to jail, which I don't think he will, he right now is the number two, but a very, very weak number two. And in addition to the pro-slavery comments, I want to say that this week he had to let go of one of his social media teams because that social media guy kept posting Nazi content again and again. So it just goes, in all seriousness, it goes to show you where the Republican Party is, Nagin, where you're given a meatball down the middle. Hey, just say slavery is bad. And they're like, nope. Gotta slavery look pretty
we
good.
We gotta both sides it. I want to note that he had to let go of 38 staffers.
Was it 38?
Yeah, 38 staffers.
What was the percentage?
Well, I don't know. I think that you're right about the like social media team, but then in general, he had to lose 38 staffers. He had like 90 staffers or something, and because he's just like can't control his expenses. And the interesting thing about all this is there's so much about a campaign that says to me nothing about how they're going to govern as a president. Like some parts of campaigning to me feel super ridiculous. Like the debate stage, that's not really a skill, right, that presidents have to use. It's more like what's happening behind the scenes and how they can and make friends and negotiate and compromise, all that stuff. Those are all skills we don't get to see on the campaign trail. But one thing that this does say to me is that like if you can't figure out your expenses and you can't figure out how to strategically message throughout a campaign in a way that will increase your numbers and not decrease them, I think you lack management skills. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's one thing that we're sort of learning about DeSantis. On top of being a wet noodle that nobody really wants to hear talk, like, he just also doesn't know how to, like, run a thing. And running a thing is literally the job. Running the biggest thing, in fact, it's the job. So it's like, if you can't do that, what are we doing? He couldn't stop using private planes to get places. Dude, like, you know, like, that those are expensive.
I wouldn't count him out just because he's posting Nazi tweets and stuff like that. But Trump used to do that all the time. That's what helped get him elected.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, he'd do more of that.
No, but
it doesn't seem to help him. Like, that, he, well, his I mean, the thing
is
this: down.
What I'll say is, Bill, it'll help him, right? In all seriousness, him doubling down on the cruelty and racism will help any candidate, as we've seen with Trump. The more racist he is, the more the base likes him. But to Nagin's point, he just looks incompetent. He looks befuddled. And he looks like he doesn't have control over his own team. He looks lost. They had to give him advice on how to talk to people at these campaign stops. And I'm like, bro, if you don't know how to even talk to people and pretend that you're listening to them and paying attention to them, and they're giving you advice on how to be a human, I don't think this is a job for you.
Well, let's quickly turn our attention to Bidenomics. It's a term that the Biden team is rolling out on the campaign trail, which was originally meant as a bit of an insult from the Wall Street Journal, but they're like reappropriating it, which I think is fun. A couple of things are true about Bidenomics. A ton of economists are downgrading the possibility of a recession. Inflation is down. Service worker wages have actually outpaced inflation for the first time in forever. So if you're a waitress or you're a bartender, you're actually earning more than you have. Unemployment is ridiculously low. Also, I don't love talking about GDP because it feels too abstract from actual day-to-day personal economics, but GDP is also doing good. So things are good, but only a third of Americans approve of Biden's handling of the economy, and his overall approval rating is at 40%. Why, Bill?
Why? It has nothing to do with the economy. It's the fact that, you know, okay, maybe he's an inspiration to the dementia functional community.
Oh,
but he just seems a little bit too much
no
of a...
I cannot
I cannot watch him on video for more than 30 seconds.
It just makes
without,
you upset.
It just makes me not... So it this doesn't is, inspire confidence.
This
Let's
is like the
op-
This is like, it's not the economy, stupid.
It's not the economy, no. And it doesn't have to be, you don't have to worry about GDP. Just go to the supermarket. What's the price of eggs? Is it over $10 for a dozen eggs? I mean, it's gone down considerably. I think that's good.
The inflation, like I said, has like leveled out, but it doesn't mean everyone feels right. But I think the idea, I mean, I think your point, and again, I don't have a problem looking at watching Biden for the record. He seems like
would
he
you want him
be,
driving you and your children around anywhere?
I wouldn't mind him sitting behind a desk and making policy decisions.
The question is, would you
let him chauffeur your car
with you and your children anywhere?
I mean, I wouldn't want George W. Bush driving me around anywhere in 2004, but like, you know what I mean? I don't know. That's not the metric for me. It's not the metric for me. What do you think about Bidenomics?
I think it's a smart pivot. He's doing what Reagan did because there were concerns about Reagan's advanced age. And Reagan, as we found out, unlike Biden, according to most folks knew at that time, he was probably suffering from some form of dementia, right? And as far as the stakes, I think the stakes are important. You always have to remind people that we're dealing with a fragile democracy in which Biden Democrats are at the very least trying to defend it and support it versus another really old guy who eats a lot of hamburgers and doesn't know how to like run or friggin' ride a bike named Trump. Right. So like when people look at like Biden's health, I'm like, at least he jogs. I've never seen Trump jog in my life. And with Bidenomics in particular, I think with time, Nagin, like give it 5 years, 6 years, I think we're going to look back and say, wow, this guy pulled off a really like it's pretty impressive. Inflation Reduction Act, infrastructure bill, right? COVID relief bill, trying his best to help people with student loan workers for the first time in 40 years are flexing. UPS workers had this big victory yesterday. In light of the fact that we literally have a Republican Party that supports an insurrection, right? And we have like literally zero help from Republicans in the House and Senate. So the fact that he's been able to do all this, I think will help him make the case in 2024. And you're not going to win over MAGA, but if you can win over enough independents and especially make the case as compared to the other guy, freaking Donald Trump, and the team that's pro-slavery, I'll take my chances with the old guy Biden driving.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an excellent point. I also think part of the problem, I actually wrote in my column about this, to promote my own column in Progressive
Even
Magazine.
Though you just did, and it's okay.
But folks, check out my column. The title is Everything Sucks, But Everything Is Fine, in my column, Hemming and Hawing in the Progressive. And in that piece, like I talk about how the performance of misery, like we all do this like performance of misery. We have a hard time accepting that like things are okay. And I understand. And I before again, like if you read the article, I do list the many things that are not okay. But like if you are talking, we started doing this thing where like you used to be like, how's it going? And you'd be like, it's going good. Thanks. But now we go, oh, I mean, the world's on fire, but whatever, you know? And it's like, is the world really on fire for you, though? We're like at a outdoor summer screening of the League of Super Pets on a lawn in New York City under the stars. So let's talk about how bad our lives really are. So I think most people spend their time doing this like performance of misery when their actual lived experience is pretty decent. And so this mismatch is like really infiltrating the way we think about our political lives. And I think I'm just really tired of it. I would love for people to sort of like really engage with like, are they doing okay?
Well, what's your benchmark for okay?
Mm. I mean, my
because honestly, I have been legitimately miserable for the past 3 years. The horrible, horrible things have happened to me to the point I don't even care about the politics. I don't have time for that. I'm focusing on survival. I'm focusing on whether or not I can get through that subway turnstile if there's enough credit on my card to get me through. Am I going to have to jump into the arms of a transit cop to try to get to where I'm going?
But like, I'm not even talking about people. I'm not talking about these kind of, I'm not saying that there aren't problems that people have on a personal level. But I also think there are plenty of people, literally, that I'll be at, like I said, an outdoor screening of League of Super Pets with children joyously eating cotton candy. Okay, like, and I'm just talking about what is so fucking bad right now, you know? So these are, I think, I'm okay with going back to being like, how you doing? Pretty good, thanks. You know what I mean? Like, I do think that that's okay. It's okay to recognize the good things in life. It doesn't have to be this performance of misery that then trickles into everything we think and do.
It's a combination, right? And I also think, Nagin, just based on your, I mean, having talked to you and known you before in the past, just your perspective on life, what you've been through, you're like one of those people who are like, the glass at least has some water in it. And it's one of those situations where for the folks who are under like anxiety, as Bill was talking about, we also have to take into consideration, like, we just barely survived a pandemic.
Yeah.
I think there's a massive international trauma that we haven't really talked about. Like, we were stuck in the home. And I,
feel like
I see
we
this
talked
especially
about it
with
constantly
teenagers.
For 3 years, we talked about it every day.
No, but like, you know what? What I'm saying is, if you talk to kids, right, especially in college, this is where I see it affecting people. Kids my age are okay, like young kids, but like kids in college, like the ones who went through it, right, like during their formative years, they're like dead-eyed,
that's
man,
rough.
Like traumatized.
Yeah.
Like, so I'm just saying it's, people are going through a lot, plus climate change, plus rising fascism, income inequality. It's just a lot. And for some people like you, and I think perhaps like me, we could be like, you know what? We've seen worse. We should be grateful.
And
other
Which
people
is my,
are like,
my general
what's better than
that?
This is terrible. What am I looking forward to? That's all. That's all I want to say.
Right, right. No, I fucking get it. And I'm not trying to shit on everybody.
No,
but
I would
also
love some
I'm
cotton
mildly
candy. You
should have
brought some. I would love some cotton candy right now.
Nagin's basically shitting on Bill. Like, Bill, how can you be grateful for your life?
That's because I made those two kid comments. That's what it was.
I'm specifically shitting on you, Bill. All right, let us move on to topic number three. We read a piece in The Guardian about first love, written by Paula Kokoza, and in it she asks, what is it about our first loves that make them so enduring in our memories, and why can we never let them go? So my first question is this: do you remember your first love? And like, more than do you remember your first love, what qualifies as a first love? Because in the article, the writer talks about a first love that she detailed from when she was 15. To me, that was more of a high school first intense high school crush. Mm. And so I guess my first question is kind of like, what do you categorize as a first love? And how often do you think about it?
That's a good question, because while you were setting it up, my question was exactly the one you posed. Well, are we looking at the first kiss, first girlfriend, first crush, like first love? You actually understand what love means and the emotions behind it. But I do, I mean, I don't know about other people, but like, I think it's very pivotal, right? I think if you ask like pretty much most boys, they're like, they'll know their first kiss. This is what's really disturbing about men. And I've shared this with my wife. Like, sometimes I forget the names of my own children, but if you tell me like this gorgeous girl who I passed up like 20 years ago, who I could have made out with, I'm like, it was 1998, August 12th. It was moist weather. Like, the temperature was 62. My wife's like, what the F? How do you know all this stuff? So I feel like, well, for me, I'll just be personal. Like, of course you remember it. It's so formative.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's a positive memory, but even if there's a negative memory, you've seen how that first love can really shape and form your aspect of masculinity and manhood. And like, it can really F you up, or it can give you the type of confidence where you look back and say, oh, hey, you know, that was a good experience. I learned from it. So I think it's very formative for most folks, especially for me it was.
Bill?
First loves.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think it depends on what you're talking about. I think every relationship, you know, they all inform your trajectory through your romantic arc, you know, and like every relationship is a response to the last one in a way. And I don't know, when you say the first relationship, I mean, that's a question of definition, right? Was it the first kiss? Was it your first crush? Was it that girl that, you know, when you were 5 years old, you realized what girls were?
Right.
Was it, you know, the girl you took to the prom, right? Or was it the first girl that you lived with, or the first girl that broke your heart?
Yeah. Mm.
You know, but I don't think about any of those nearly as much as the last one, which tried to destroy my life and came very close. I'm more focused on the last one than the first one these days. That's much more formative than a daily psychology. I can't get into it now because that's not the topic.
I have a sense Bill is a divorcee, is what I'm
worse than divorcee. I tried to avoid divorce by not getting married, and I ended up in the same problem anyway.
It doesn't matter.
I think Bill should do another podcast called Last Love.
Yeah. Hopefully.
I mean, so one of the interesting things we learned by reading this piece is that, so part of the reason why all these things are so memorable, while you remember the moistness in the air, Waj, when you saw that hot lady, was because the pathway in the brain where this kind of first love stuff is not where the emotions are. This pathway is right next to the factory that orchestrates your drive for hunger, for thirst, the drive for shelter, the drive to learn, the drive to create, and the evolutionary driven need to send your DNA into tomorrow, as the article put it. And so it is like, there's also, they found that it's in the addiction center of the brain. So where you fall in love with someone, you're actually like addicted to them.
Is that a surprise to anybody?
No, but the surprise to me is that there's science that backs it. Like, it does feel like an addiction in the beginning. Like when you're in the heyday, those early days of love or whatever, which I also want to say we could categorize as lust. A lot of this shit, I think we could categorize as lust.
But it's also, like you said, like that science has been out there for a while. And they said the feeling is of that first love, that crush, when that first week or 2 weeks where you're just so into a person. It's like, it's better than cocaine. And I haven't done cocaine yet, but I'm assuming they're saying it's like a drug. It's like a drug hit. It's like the euphoric hit you get from the best drug. It's better than that.
Well, it's the only addiction that you're born with. Even before you try it, you're addicted to it. You know, and by the time you get your first taste of it, like, it just doubles the addiction that you're already, it just unleashes that addiction. You were wired for that.
And what's interesting, actually, that the piece brought up was that a lot of people that wrote into The Guardian about this talked about like not being able to overcome their first love. They got a lot of people writing in that were in their 60s and their 70s who felt like they could never fully love again after their first love. And so they'll have a story from when they were like 17 or 18, and they're like 70 and they still can't kind of like feel that same way. And the reason for that is that, like, a failed first love is a form of trauma, according to scientists, and according to psychologists. This is not how I feel about my first lusts and loves, but did any of that ring true for you, Bill? That, like, there's, like a, tra- that like, a the, trauma
the,
feeling around it?
What makes the first ones stand out and be formative and be special is that you were so innocent. You had no idea what was coming. You didn't know the brick wall that you were going to smash into at 1,000 miles per hour, you know? So you go into it full force, right? You're like with open arms. What could go wrong? This is the best thing in the world. But after you get crushed a few times, you know, you're not as quick to fall in. Or even if you do, you know what the risks are, and knowing the risks emotionally changes the whole experience. You know, you're not going into it with that same blind spot or that same clean slate. You know, the chances are there's some sort of landmine that chances are you will step into at some point. And it makes you a little bit, it makes you second guess going full force into anything ever again. And your first one, you didn't have that hesitance at all.
Well, and it's interesting that you mentioned that the innocence in part of that, again, according to these neurobiologists, is that our strongest and sharpest memories from lifetime form between the ages of 10 and 30 with a peak at age 15. So we're a lot of these stories are coming around that peak. And they're coming, they're happening in this 10 to 30 age range where we're forming the strongest memories. So, you know, you're right, Bill, that we are innocent and we're also forming the strongest memories at that time. And so I think, I mean, one thing that I feel about my, you know, what's, I think, interesting to me about all of the first love feelings is as like, I had so many insecurities as an adolescent and as a teen. The fact that like a guy made out with me brought me out a lot of those insecurities where I was like, oh my God, I am fuckable. And it felt like, you know, it just felt like, oh my God, the world is my oyster. I'ma go out and fuck everyone I see. Like it was so, the feeling, it was like a triumph. Like it felt, it's funny because I almost had the opposite of the trauma that these people are talking about where it was like failed first love. I was just like, oh no, I can achieve this. That's awesome. Let me go like achieve it again.
Mine was the same way, Nagin, is that so much of it, you know, growing up was this fascination with this opposite sex. I didn't know how to talk to them. I was shy, wore husky pants. I was sick. And then like, it took me a long time to realize that, oh, like these women really liked me, right? And like, and they like my personality and they're into me. And then I think, talking about shaping and forming, right? Those two words keep coming up and how it could be a source of joy or trauma.
Yeah.
I've been very lucky because with my relationship with women, right? The previous you know, girlfriends or the women I talked to, it gave me, I think what's kept protecting me from going like down to the bitter, angry, like Andrew Tate fans is that the women in my life always helped me. And we're always a source of joy and comfort and like protection, right? So it's one of those situations where if I had a traumatic experience and like my first three girlfriends crushed my heart, I think I'd be a much different person right now, right?
Yeah, you'd be me.
You know, that's why it's so important.
Folks, let me know, how did your first love inform the rest of your life? Is it something you're still lamenting on? And hit me up on all the social medias that we shouldn't be on. All right. And that, my friends, is the end of the show. What a wonderful time I had speaking with both of you, despite the fact that you have more children than me. And obviously, your lives are more difficult.
I'll lend them to you if that'll help you get them.
And we're just stronger and more resilient
people.
You're
just stronger and more resilient people. And that's it. That's just what I need to learn. No, I love you guys. And I want the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you and all the wonderful things that you do. Bill Santiago, where do they do that?
At Bill Santiago all over the place.
Great.
BillSantiagoComedy.com.
Also look him up on Spotify if you don't live in a town where he's performing.
Amazon, the book, pardon my Spanglish, all that stuff.
Bookshop.org.
Wherever you want to get your book.
You know what I mean? Try and do it from an independent bookseller. I'm just saying. Wajahat Ali, where do they do it?
Well, there was this health site called Twitter, which is now called X. And on X, I'm at Wajahat Ali until that site shuts down. I'm also on Threads and Instagram at Insta Wajahat. And yeah, I just wrote a book. The paperback came out this year called Go Back to Where You Came From and other helpful recommendations on how to become American.
Oh my God. Do yourself a favor and read his book. Follow him on defunct and non-defunct social media platforms. he's just such a breath of fresh air. And folks, you know what I where to find me, but I just want to let people know that if you are in New York City on Friday night at Caveat, we'll be doing Wait Wait's Casual Fridays. So Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me is doing just like a loosey-goosey version of the show in New York City at Caveat on Friday. I believe there's some tickets left.
That's a nice place, that Caveat.
Oh, it's so delightful. I've performed there a lot, and I always love it. So come out to Caveat on the Lower East Side and enjoy a fun. I'm going to be hosting. Some of your favorite panelists are going to be panelisting. It's going to be a fun show. And also, I will be in the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me stand-up tour in St. Paul on August 18th, in Kansas City on August 19th. So definitely come out and see us in those two cities. It's going to be so fun. And I will also be doing Wait, Wait in Chicago on August 24th. And there may be more news on that, but that's looks like that's happening. So, you know, so many opportunities to engage specifically in the Wait-Wait-a-verse. Don't forget to check out my piece, Everything Sucks But Everything Is Fine, in Progressive magazine, which I don't even normally like promote this column very much, but I do feel like this one I want more people to check out, just because I feel we can all feel better.
I want some of that cotton candy.
Yeah, there it is. And I would love to thank everyone who makes the show a possibility. That's our wonderful producer, Andrew McGuire. Thank you to everyone at HeadGum. That's right. Applause. Thank you to everyone at HeadGum who makes the show a possibility. Thank you to Gabby Alter, who wrote our theme music. You can reach us at fakethenationpodcast@gmail.com with any ideas you might have about the show, any ideas you have about recap shows. And we will be back in your earballs next week.
That was a HeadGum podcast.